The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius Tactheratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a lockdown.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Got my head out of my ass.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on band.video, vigilante.tv, Rockfin, Odyssey, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We know you got a lot of choices. We appreciate it. If you like this show, you can share it with your friends and family. You can find me. The website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Macroaggression, where I argue with robots. Thank you to our sponsors. We couldn't do the show without you. LegalZoom, or LegalShield, I should say, has been fantastic for us. They're our newest sponsor. This is a company that has been in business for 50 years. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, and their services are available in the United States and Canada. Basically, it's the collective buying power of all of us directed towards high-power law firms in your area. Get you access to an attorney that on average has 22 years of experience. It's going to cost you $1 a day, $30 a month. To have all of this covered. I asked the question, it's a simple one. When is the last time you updated your will? If the answer is, I don't even have a will, well, look, you got to get one. You got to get this paperwork taken care of. You need one for yourself, for your spouse, if you have one. Do you have a medical power of attorney? Do you have a financial power of attorney? These are documents you've got to have. Put them in your safe, but they're going to cost you a couple $1,000s to get all that stuff taken care of. So this is a suggestion I make. If you're interested, if you think it is right for you, you can sign up for Legal Shield. And within the first month of your membership, set up an appointment with the law firm in your area and go in and get all these things taken care of. Okay. It's right there. You've just paid this service off for the next, I don't know, 8 years or so. So think about that. It's not just legal protection. There's also ID Shield, which is credit monitoring, reputation management, and password manager. There's also a small business plan. If you carry a gun, there's also gun licensing and registration documentation in there as well. There's all kinds of things. So this is what I suggest. If you're interested, or it sounds like an opportunity you might want to find out more about, just go to the website they created for us, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com, and see what you think. See if it's right for you. If it is, sign up. If not, that's okay. But if you've got traffic tickets, if there's an IRS audit, if you're just unsure about what your rights are, God knows we all are. Rights are being turned into privileges and removed from us on a weekly basis. So listen, talk to an attorney. I'm not an attorney. You're probably not an attorney either. But these people that work for Legal Shield, these law firms, they can help you out. Never sign another document without running it by your attorney. If your work wants you to sign something funky that's new having to do with medical directives or something about getting injections before you're allowed to show up at work, do not sign that. Send that to your letter to your lawyer first before you do anything. Go to www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. See if it's right for you. Also, Chemical Free Body has been, well, I've been on their products now. We're coming up on 3 years. I feel fantastic. Tim James is a great friend. I trust him. He believes in his products so much. He has a double your money back guarantee. If you don't like it, you can just send it back to him. But I'll tell you what, you're going to love the results in an industry filled with scammy products that don't work. I'm glad I have Tim. So look, if 2023 is the year that you finally decide that you're the only person that's going to be able to take care of your health, you can't outsource it to somebody else, go to chemicalfreebody.com. See what you think. So I take the Green 85 every single morning. There's a detox bundle package that you can get, which is gut detox, toxin detox, ultra enzymes, probiotics, and then you mix in a couple cans of Green 85 and you do that for 90 days. It will lean you out. I have the visual proof of it. Poor Tim James, man. I told him he owed me new shorts because I lost so much weight and I wasn't trying to, that I had to get a new size of shorts. So look, chemicalfreebody.com is the website. The promo code is MACRO if you are interested in getting yourself healthy in the new year. Well, a couple days ago, I had a really fun conversation with Sean Atwood, who has become a pretty good friend of mine. And it was a group chat. And we had the great Jay Dyer on, and we had such a good conversation. I was hoping maybe we could continue it. So if you are unfamiliar with Jay's work, well, first of all, how dare you? And second of all, why don't you go over to his website, jaysanalysis.com. You can find everything you need about him. He is an author. He has written Esoteric Hollywood, both 1 and 2. And if you are the type of person that listens to Alex Jones, you can catch him on Friday in the 4th hour, filling in for Alex Jones, the host of InfoWars. That is Jay Dyer. Hey, Jay. Good to see you again. How you doing?
Thanks, man. Yeah, we went way too long before chatting again. So it was good to reconnect on that podcast with Sean. And yeah, Sean's a cool guy. We've been doing some podcasts over the last couple of years. And I was really surprised that podcast we were on, that's doing really well. It's got like 100,000 views today, I noticed.
But Sean and I connected a couple of years ago. I really like him. And you know about his past as a ecstasy dealing kingpin who did 6 years in federal prison and went writing a lot of this work. We started talking about our personal lives, we found out that we were in the same nightclub on Millennial New Year's Eve in Las Vegas as one another obviously many years before we knew each other. And I don't know, I can't speak for him, but I was definitely up to no good that night. But I'm sure he was too. So our paths have crossed before. It's really good to have a guy like Sean in your corner. And also, listen, frankly, to have a guy like you, that I don't think I mean, are you having a contest with Richard Grove to see who can read the most obscure books? Because I feel like my money would be on you, but it wouldn't be too. I mean, I might hedge my bet.
Well, that might only be because Richard's got kids and, we haven't had that experience yet, me and Jamie. So if we get kids, I'm sure there'll be a lot less reading on our side. But that's why Richard and I teamed up, was because, you know, we'd done podcasts over the years, kind of back and forth just as friends, and then found out that, more and more our topics and our paths were overlapping. So I just did a 12-week lecture course for him at Autonomy University. That'll go on sale in the next couple of days, the whole history of Western philosophy. So really happy to be linked up and doing more stuff with Richard. He's become a good friend of mine.
He's great. And he came on, we talked about that too. We talked about not just his 9/11 story, which is crazy, but autonomy in general. Just that the idea that, you know, this is the future of education, as far as I'm concerned. You cannot outsource this to the state. You cannot let government schools be in charge of educating your kids, yourself, whatever. And if you think, you know, because the school system ends at 12th grade, that that's when education ends as well. You're fooling yourself. You know, you, this is a lifelong process. Things that I was into when I was 17 or 18 years old, I'm not as into now. Things have changed and things have
evolved. Thank God, right? I'll still be listening to Green Day CDs. I mean, like, I think that when I was like 17, 16, I was like, the coolest thing was when I got Green Day's first album. I was like, yeah, I'm going to be a, like, you know, into like, I'm into alternative. I didn't really like punk music, but Green Day was my exposure to pop punk. So I guess that was
it, it's the KY jelly of the punk scene. Okay. Yeah, it'll sort of ease you into it a little bit. But it's and look, but this education system is a slave system, and to break out of it and to find guys like Richard that's doing autonomy. I had John Bush on. He's doing agorism type workshop programs. I'm about to head to Anarchapulco in a couple of weeks and talk to the guys there. And there's always programs happening workshops that are happening afterwards. This is a lifelong process. So tell me a little bit about the class that would you call it a class?
It was intended. It was intended to be essentially. I mean, it's not as long. I think I looked it up. Like, if you did a full semester of a college course, would be, you know, a few more hours lectures than what I gave. But it ended up being, I think, 30, 35, maybe even 40 hours of total chat. So it was a lot of work. It was actually a little more work than I expected, but I'm glad because I like the challenge of putting all that together. And what we did was a whole history of Western philosophy. And we started with the pre-Socratics. We went through Plato. We went through Aristotle, we went through some of the early Christian philosophers, Stoics. We went up into the Middle Ages guys with Aquinas and Scotus and those characters. And we went into Descartes, Renaissance, empiricists, Enlightenment philosophers in general. And then we got all the way up to Nietzsche, existentialism, postmodernism. So we compacted. I think it came out really good. And it's perfect for people who I call it it's an educated person's introduction to philosophy. I mean, if you have no interest in philosophy, you're not going to like it at all. If you're new to philosophy, it's perfect for you. If you're kind of, you know, somewhat well-read. I don't think people who have no interest in it at all or no background of education, but I intended it to kind of be the perfect introduction to the history of Western philosophy. So, and there's specifically three separate course classes within the overall course, which were the three branches of philosophy. So we had one course on epistemology, one course on metaphysics, and one course on ethics. So it turned out perfect. It was amazing. I'm really thankful to Richard for that opportunity. And I think what we're going to do now is I want to do more courses. So I want to teach a course on history of geopolitics and espionage. I want to teach a course on the Global Elite book series. You know, we've got 50 or 60 of those texts that we can work from. So, you know, sky's the limit here. Ultimately, I'd like to have a whole kind of bundle of, you know, like maybe 5-10 classes that are just kind of ready to go.
I'm working on a class with Richard. It's on gender studies. Yeah, it's going
to
be.
Are you going to show us how to change? Like how? I'm just joking.
Right, cake gender in it is after lunch. Yeah, it's going to be a 15-minute class. Very simple. It costs $1.
Are you actually going to teach a course, or are you just joking?
No. I actually would love to do something like that. Like I know when you said that it was a little bit more work than what you signed up for, but you kind of liked it.
I like that. Yeah.
That's how I feel when I start. I've written three books, and I've got an idea for a fourth one. And I like it's that early on stage when you just start to write, and then you go, "Oh shit, what have I done?" This is even bigger than I thought. I thought I was writing something a little bit more narrow, and the more I get in, I can't just leave this. I have to go explain the backstory to this. And I was having this conversation with Whitney Webb. She goes, yeah, it turned into two books for me. You know, she's like, I wrote book two, and then it was like, well, I have to explain like all of this. And so I really need a pre-book to warm you up. So I get that. I kind of like that too. It's kind of exciting when you go, oh, I'm really in the deep end. I better learn to swim or else it's going to be ugly. But I think that would be great for you to do even more series, because you're really well-rounded and know a ton of stuff about topics that I mean, it's just, let's be honest. I mean, it's not, you're not going to learn this stuff in college. I don't know of a college that's going to offer these sorts of classes, but I think that you would be better prepared for the real world, the actual world, if you sat through a bunch of your classes and autonomy classes than you would be if you got a gender study degree at.
Well, that's essentially worthless. That's just, you're just paying to be brainwashed, right? So. Yeah, I mean, the model that Richard has is, the like you said, the future. And the whole idea here is that the purpose of education is to teach you how to teach yourself. That's the whole point, right? You learn critical thinking to continue learning. It's not repeat back stuff for 12 years and then you're done with education. You know, it's intended for people who want to learn their entire life, but have the skills there to continue learning in the right way and to think in the right way. And so, you know, he's spot on all that. And that's the right approach. So, you know, I thank you for your kind words. I appreciate that. You know, I just happen to have a weird life and a weird background and, you know, take a lot of different weird turns in my life. And that, for me, was a lot of university time, grad school time that would have actually been better spent doing the kinds of things that you're talking about, that we're talking about with autonomy. But in a weird turn of, I guess, providence, you could say that being in the state school system for many years, university and grad school, like I saw how deficient that was.
Yeah,
there's some pros to it. I mean, it is the only pro I can think of really that is that you are forced to write a lot of papers, and there is an advantage to writing a lot in college and grad school where you don't just take in information, you actually have to chew on it and you have to kind of spit out your thoughts in a reasoned, coherent way. And I think that writing does get you to think in a kind of a better, higher frame of focus, I guess you could say, than if you're just doing talking. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. But it was like when we were putting the course together, it's been forever since I'd created hundreds of slides. So I just got so bogged down in creating all these hundreds. That was the hard part. Talking about philosophy and reviewing and reading and getting back into the text is not hard. For me, it was just the discipline of doing the monotonous kind of slides over and over and over and doing hundreds of those. So that was the work for me. But in the end, that actually also is helpful too, because you're kind of like basically summarizing and writing, you know, the main ideas of the history of Western philosophy. So I feel like I kind of like reinvigorated myself with all the stuff I learned in undergrad and kind of compacted it into, you know, to 12 weeks. So there's pros and cons. Again, I think the only thing missing is just that the state school system does enforce, which this could theoretically be done outside. It's not like they have a monopoly on making people write papers, but there is something to writing just hundreds and hundreds of papers for several years that actually makes you a good writer.
Absolutely. And I've had people ask me, like, how do you remember all this stuff? I'll be on a podcast and someone asks me some question and I'll rattle off something and they go, how do you remember all this stuff? It's not because I'm some like savant or anything. It's from writing. And when you're just writing a book and you're in a chapter, yes, and the chapter, right, is taking you like an entire week to get this stuff down, you're just in this information and looking at it over and over. And there's something about typing or physically write. I handwrite all my notes for the shows that I do. And
not for shows, but in terms of books, I do. Like, people always ask, why is your book all marked up? I'm like, because that's how I remember it, man. Like, yeah, if I underline half of the book, then it means it's in my head.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's how it works for me.
That's how it works for me too. And I didn't set out to memorize, you know, and if someone said, oh, I need you to memorize all this stuff for a test tomorrow, I'd be like, ah, you know, but if I'm not trying to memorize it, you know, of course, and on top of that, if it's totally irrelevant and useless information, I can't get it out of my head. It goes in there and it just stays. So if you want to know some obscure baseball stat from 30 years ago, it's in my head, but you want to remember what, you know, I need to.
Well, I find that actually kind of impressive. People that can remember like old stats and stuff. I can't do that very well.
But that's because I was watching all the games. I was like, oh, I remember watching this game, you know, and things like that. So, so what's the plan for more books? Is there a plan
In a sense, you could say two new books this year. So one, the new book is all the philosophical essays in one book. So that one's called Meta Narratives.
Okay.
And it's just the 15 best essays that I thought I'd done that aren't in the Hollywood books, because obviously those are about Hollywood. So, but on my website, there was it was about 1,000 pages more than the Hollywood stuff. There was all the geopolitical essays, all the philosophical essays, a bunch of theology essays. So I kind of boiled those down to one book that's called Meta-Narratives, Essays on Philosophy and Symbolism, which we put out a few months ago. And that has done pretty good. It sold, I think, a little better than I expected. I just self-published that one. I didn't go with Trine Day. But that's because Trine Day doesn't do philosophy. So, and then somebody, a weird thing, somebody without my permission published all of my theology essays and geopolitical essays into one book. And they started selling it on Lulu. And I tried to get it taken down, but every time I get it taken down, it would just go right back up. So I just decided to roll with it. So technically, there's another book, which is it's called The Red Book, kind of like Carl Jung or Mao Zedong. It's Jay's Red Book, which is 660 pages of all the philosophy and theology and geopolitical essays. So those are all collected into a whole other book, which you can get at the website too, if you want the full 600 page book. But that one is kind of like thrown together. It's not edited super well. It's, again, I have no idea who did this, just might did it, but I just, if I can't get it taken, might as well just roll with it. So
it happened to me too.
Somebody do that.
Erwick and I put out, this is crazy. We put out The Controlled Demolition of the American Empire on the Friday before the elections in 2020. It became a number one bestseller on election Tuesday. And I was like, oh, the irony, because no one will read, nobody that reads this book will ever vote in an election. It's perfect for that. But we put it out on Friday. On Saturday, there was a bootleg version of it on Amazon. Wow. I was like, what in the hell is it? Is this some sort of like AI writing thing? And it was, it was like a summary of The Controlled Demolition of the American Empire. I looked at it and we were like, I was like, well, I go, Jeff, what do you want to do? You want to take it down? He goes, I don't care. He goes, I don't care. I go, I don't care either. It's fine. If that's their little niche is to put these books out super fast, then I don't have a problem
with it. This one was weird because we don't have to keep talking about this, but they put time into it. Because they went and got all of the essays from my website. And I'm kind of glad they did it on the one hand. I mean, it would have been nice if they'd asked permission, but they probably felt like I would have said no. But they did it because of the website getting deleted in 2018. So they thought it would kind of just it would go away. And I think that for a lot of those old essays, there's good value, especially in some of the theology essays. So I think their thinking was, we'll do this to preserve it. And it's just all the essays kind of compacted into just like a self-print thing. So, whatever. They did put some time into it and they have kind of fixed it and edited it a little bit. But it's just bizarre. It's bizarre we were at a conference and a guy brought the book for me to sign it. And I was like, what is this? And he's like, it's all of your writings. And I'm like, how do you have a book I don't even know what this is. And he's like, oh, I just found it online. I was like, okay, well, that's not my book, but it is, right? But so yeah, that was weird.
That's really funny. Well, you've been writing about Hollywood and in esoteric Hollywood 1 and 2. I saw the clips of the Golden Globes with Zelensky promising the Hollywood elite, I use that term very loosely, that there will not be a World War III. And we have Sean Penn. We have Sean Penn, the CIA asset, giving his Oscar to Zelensky in Ukraine. We have U2 doing a concert in a railway station. We have David Letterman going, what the fuck is going on in Ukraine? can we just get down to the bottom of this? Like, this all feels like Wag the Dog to me.
Yeah, great analogy there. That's a classic movie. I think I put the Wag the Dog analysis in the second movie, the second book, I think, that we did. But yeah, I mean, Ukraine is great for illustrating this point of those books, right? That Ukraine is kind of a Hollywood thing. I mean, why is Hollywood so concerned with a war theater? By the way, I thought Hollywood was always against wars, right? I mean, that's right. At least through the 60s, 70s, 80s, we were told that, war was bad. Now that the wars are all promoted by the, quote, leftists, now it's good, supposedly. Of course, I would say that all modern wars basically are for the military-industrial complex and for the banks, and so they're all bad. I think maybe you go back to the Middle Ages, you could justify self-defense-based wars, But modern wars, no, they're you know, it's like Smedley Butler said, they're it's a racket. So I think it's really, you know, bizarre the how open a lot of this stuff is now, with, you said, with Zelensky hanging out with Hollywood people going to meet with him. It's a big vindication, really, of a lot of the stuff that was in my old essays, which I just stumbled upon. I didn't have any expectation that when I started reading about the relationship between Hollywood and the CIA, that it would be as intimate as it actually is. In fact, when I read a book, I think in 2006, was my first exposure to that idea. And I thought it was crazy. I was like, I grew up loving movies. I was always a movie buff. And I thought, I don't know, that's a little much, right? That sounds a little out there. I mean, I was already a conspiracy theorist, right? So right. Even to a conspiracy theorist person in 2005, I thought that was out there. And then, you know, studying that at an academic setting and getting deeper and deeper into it. And then I would just come across all of these academic people who had already been writing about it. And then here we are, that was 2005. So 17 years later, to see that playing out on the global scene, and we're actually seeing CIA Hollywood people, like you mentioned, Sean Penn, who, by the way, would go and meet with El Chapo. Why is he going and meeting with El Chapo? Like, some random the
same Hollywood height? I don't know.
But when you understand, right, the thesis of the book and all that, it makes perfect sense, right? So it's all propaganda. It's all theater. It's war psyops. And all psyops really comes out of the war theater, actually. And a lot of that was taken and put into movies, which I know you know that, but people may not know that Jamie and I, for example, you know, we've done tons of analysis of 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s movies. But lately, we've been going back and watching a lot of the golden era, silver era, you know, of Hollywood. And I'm surprised even at how much propaganda was in those. I knew they were propagandists because you can go all the way back to the 1920s and find, Howard Hughes movies being propaganda. But like, dude, all of these Bogart movies, they're almost all war propaganda movies. And I'd never even thought about that. Not right.
Me either.
If you go watch them, and I'm not saying the Axis powers are good guys. Obviously, they're bad guys, too. I think it was a managed thing. I think that the money power and the industrialists were funding both sides of that war. But basically, any of those Bogart-Bacall movies, they're almost all war propaganda movies. And some of them are actually about the need for America to get involved in the war effort. And then we're talking about movies coming out right at 1945, 46, 47, 48. Jamie and I have been through about 30 of these in the last couple of months. So we're kind of blown away at that. Even a lot of the Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre movies. Those are a lot of war propaganda films too. One of the ones that really surprised us was, what's that one? Was it Bing Crosby and all that? That had the blackface and all that crazy stuff. Is that it, Jamie? Holiday Inn is crazy. That's also a huge Americanist propaganda thing too, for getting us kind of mobilized for wartime stuff. I mean, so it's just like every day, I don't know how to explain this. Like when this is a domain, a rabbit hole where you think you kind of have it all laid out, and then like you get blown away by a whole another level of it that you didn't even know about. Like I knew that, for example, Hitchcock was involved in working with the British Ministry of Information to film propaganda, but I didn't even know. Richard pointed this out the other day. There were entire film studios that the British intelligence had made up. I think it's called London Films. They were just completely MI6 fronts. Like entire film studios created as intelligence fronts, which I knew there was one in the UK that was a Soviet front. I don't remember the name of it, but like there's some more that you go into. It's just like this is a particularly fascinating rabbit hole that just sort of never ceases to, you know, reemerge with new information. And it's not any different nowadays when, you know, a lot of these A-listers, it's kind of coming out more and more. Ben Affleck had that famous interview, I think in 2012 with The Guardian or The Telegraph, where he says Hollywood and the CIA are the flip sides of the same coin. So that's what's the explanation of Hollywood and Ukraine. But beyond that, Ukraine is just a giant, as you know, geopolitical strategy point, resources. It's a giant money laundering operation. Everybody knows about the Biden, you know, corruption there. I mean, that's what that is.
My buddy, who I went to college with, who by all accounts, I don't remember him ever really having a background in movies or movie writing. His brother was a director, but then he went to work for a think tank and I didn't really think much of it. I honestly didn't even really know what that was back then. And then he leaves the think tank, and all of a sudden he starts writing political movies, like big ones, good ones. Like,
so he starts writing screenplays, right?
Yeah. The Kingdom, yeah. The Saudi Arabia one, Lions for Lambs, Generation Z, or World War Z. He wrote all these, and I go, wait a second. Oh, he's a good guy. I mean, I don't think he's a bad guy, but I was like, so you came out of the think tank and then you started writing the movies. And I just thought, well, that seems like it was made to happen, kind of. I'm not trying to discount his success, but
yeah, right.
But I do know from living, you know, we were living in LA. I mean, we know a lot of people are trying to get movies made. Not many people do. And all of a sudden you're getting like a bunch of movies and they're all a certain political sort of slant, and America's the good guy always. And we've got a zombie apocalypse, but we've got to save the day. And I'm thinking, is there more to this? Does he even know? I mean, I got to think he knows on some level, but I haven't had this conversation with him and I haven't talked to him in a long, long time. I would be interested to find out. But after starting to learn that the Department of Defense has like an office in Hollywood, I go, oh, okay. And I kind of jokingly, like in one of the books, wrote like a list of all of these movies that needed to get approval from the DOD, script approval, you know, in order to use their aircraft carriers that are F-16s or whatever. And you can sort of, you know, you can sort of understand Top Gun, the new Red Dawn and all these things, you know, but then you get down to the bottom of the list and it's like Ernest Saves Christmas. Yeah. Seriously? Had to be approved by the DOD? Like, what's going on in there? So I think that we sort of like can be dismissive about the role of the military, the Pentagon in Hollywood, but it's very real, because those movies, man, when you get in that seat and the lights go off and the screen turns on, you emotionally let your guard down in order to sort of believe the unbelievable. And while your guard is down, I feel like they have used that opportunity to subconsciously get in there and start to make you feel one way or the other. Has that been your experience?
Oh, absolutely. That's why all the guys from World War II that were in wartime intelligence, OSS people, it's all of the heads of the major networks were people from OSS. So they just took their wartime intelligence psyops and applied it to not just the advertising networks. They also went to Madison Avenue. So they applied all that information to marketing and you know, how to sell stuff. And if you watch Mad Men, this is kind of hinted at with the Don Draper character, because he's a former military dude who has a shady background or whatever. And then, by the way, the series ends with him going to the Esalen Institute, which is another kind of deep state funded kind of mind control operation, which was kind of the brains behind the 60s countercultural revolution, in my view. But yeah, I think that you can, again, like this rabbit hole never ends, because you can go into, like, they've even studied a lot of this at a scientific level. Like when people watch a car wreck, like where the eyes are on the screen, the heart rate, and what specifically happens in an event on a screen to affect the body in a certain way. That's all been studied to a scientific level. They were even doing studies on how, when Hitchcock's Psycho premiered, how it affected the audience, because people have never seen, like when we watch it now, it's kind of like ridiculous and kind of silly cheeseball, but people have never seen a slasher movie before. So they were like freaking out, right? So, and that's relevant because, like, Hitchcock was basically filming stuff, maybe not that movie, obviously, but many, many films for British intelligence, right? Ministry of Information is just another branch of British intelligence. And he filmed a lot of war propaganda films too. So, you know, they were very intently interested in how exactly does film affect people, not just in an ideological sense, that was most important, but also how it can affect people in a physio, you know, physiognomy, biological sense.
Yeah.
And if film does do that, it has the power to do that. And I don't know if I can recommend this movie. It was really weird, but we saw Babylon last night, and I don't want to spoil the movie, but that was it's a meta movie about Hollywood, right? That's the story is about how Hollywood transitioned from silent films to talkies to where it is now. And how basically it's done for in the classical sense of Hollywood. But some of this actually comes up, like the way that movies can program us to it's sort of the new narrative, our new myth maker, our new, you know, like the ancient world had the stories of gods. I mean, that's kind of Hollywood, and they're self-cognizant of that. And that's what Babylon was about. So now the narrative is no longer the studio is kind of telling people their mythology. Oh, my camera just died, or my light just died. Oh well, sorry. It's gonna be me kind of in a shady.
It's like gonna back. Look like you're in witness protection program. That's all.
We're going to have to talk like this, where the local news changes the voice, and now I show. You know, it's not like a witness. Yeah. Like, yeah, the local news changes your voice to sound like some weirdo. Anyway, but yeah, so I'm rambling, but yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Well, let me ask you this, since we're talking about Hollywood and we're talking about mind control and we're talking about rabbit holes, maybe even actual rabbits here, bunnies, what's the role of Hugh Hefner in Hollywood? Because he strikes me as an interesting dude who was... You know, I mean, if I didn't know any better, I would think he had the West Coast franchise of that same Epstein having the East Coast franchise of this blackmail entrapment operation. We've got the Playboy Mansion. I know, you know, everyone, you know, I know a lot of people that have gone there and to go to the parties and all that stuff. And they never really had any good stories, but they also weren't trying to be entrapped by Hollywood. Yeah. But my guess is that for a while there, at least, it was a fantastic way to get people to, again, voluntarily put their guard down and then find themselves in some sort of maybe unspeakable situations that are recorded. What do you know about the role of Hugh Hefner in general and the Playboy Mansion in particular as some sort of entrapment op?
Yeah, I think it did come out, I think a year ago. I know RT did a whole write-up on it that the mansion was bugged in some degree with cameras and whatnot. So I wouldn't be at all surprised about that. I've also heard stories, rumors of other mansions. I think there's one supposedly in New Orleans that is bugged in this way. That's a famous kind of visited by, you know, elites and famous people. And of course, it goes on in Vegas too. So there's probably always been this deep connection between madams and intelligence agencies and organized crime. That's always going together. Just all the way back to the mafia days, right? That was going on. And that, I mean, even comes up in Godfather 2, right? Where the senator that won't give the Corleones the right to run the casinos in Vegas, like he ends up next to a hooker who's died and they've got dirt on him, right? So and I know, of course, that's what, you know, Whitney Webb's book's about. I just got those in the mail the other day, looking forward to getting into those. But you know, we've seen that too with the stories about Franklin cover-up, John DeCant. We've seen this with Epstein. We've seen this with a lot of different operations like this. And I think that Hugh Hefner, I don't know if he was a CIA person, but he did, Playboy magazine did early on get CIA money. And that was at a time period when the CIA was funding all kinds of projects, seed projects. They gave money to, you know, Gloria Steinem and Miss Magazine. They gave money to Playboy. They were funding all kinds of magazines, supposedly under the guise of the Cold War and, you know, fighting Sovietism. But in actuality, this, in my view, was large-scale culture creation and culture steering projects is what I really think this is about. And so a lot of the music from that time period got CIA money. A lot of the modern art, Jackson Pollock, Andy Warhol, they all got CIA money. There's Dave McGowan's book on the weird scenes inside the canyon, the Laurel Canyon scene, being a lot of military intelligence and CIA stuff. So yeah, I think that's what was going on with, I think, and it's possible that he could have even been a handler. I mean, I don't know that, just theoretical, but you know, he's basically kind of a pimp, right? Because he's got like this stable of like 12, you know, bombshell blondes that he can tell him to sleep with whoever. And, you know, that's just a compromised operation, I would say.
Yeah. Okay. So I have no knowledge about this next topic at all, but I know you do. So I'm going to ask you, because I don't have anyone else to ask, what is going on at the Vatican? what happened with the Benedict, right? He's dead now, right? He left in a helicopter years ago, right? And went away. And now he's passed away. And it seems like there's some sort of it's like the woke Pope that we've got now. And I don't know enough about this to really comment in a knowledgeable way. I'm kind of hoping you will fill in the gaps as to what is the situation. Is it stable there at the Vatican? Is there a power? Is there some sort of fight going on behind the scenes that we don't know? It seems very, it always felt really boring to me. Like there was nothing going on. And now it seems like there's a lot going on, and I wish I knew more about it. Hopefully you can fill me in on what's happening there.
Yeah, I do know a good bit about this. So I would say that the best book on this is David Wim Hof's book on John Courtney Murray and the CIA and the relationship between the Jesuits and the CIA. And this is coming from a Catholic scholar. This is not a lowbrow internet conspiracy theory, the Jesuits run everything type of thing. That's kind of stupid to me. But there have been pretty well-known, famous, longtime connections between Western intelligence and the Jesuits, particularly the CIA. And many of the prominent Jesuit universities that we know about in the United States are famously also openly connected to CIA heads. John Brennan, for example, the Fordham University is a famous Jesuit school. They have a whole John Brennan department. I mean, it's named after him because, this is an open relationship that a lot of people know about. And the explanation for this is what's called the doctrinal warfare program during the Cold War. And this is the brainchild of C.D. Jackson from the CIA, who, together with Henry Luce of Time Magazine, cooked up this idea. And behind Henry Luce and a lot of that he was Skull and Bones. And this is like the Rockefeller WASP network that wanted to get the Vatican on board with basically being an NGO. So the best explanation is that the people at Time Magazine, CIA, Skull and Bones, Rockefeller, they said, let's take this giant Catholic institution and it can have some of its Catholicism elements, but we want it to be an engine of Americanism. And so what that meant was a lot of the older ideas of traditional Catholicism would have to be updated, would need to be changed. It needed to be an engine to promote American foreign policy. And the excuse for this was, well, we got the Cold War. We got to do all this, right? And so effectively what happened at the time of Vatican II was that the CIA ended up gaining a tremendous amount of influence over the Vatican. Now, in my view, the Vatican had already been corrupt. I don't think that, it's just suddenly in the 60s corrupted. You can go all the way back to the Renaissance and pick out all kinds of, really bizarre money, power connections and control, going all the way back to the 1500s and the 1700s. That's a whole other topic. But for the 20th century, the explanation is that at the time of Vatican II, there was absolutely 100% a public declassified program on the part of the CIA to change the institutional face of the Catholic Church to become an engine of American foreign policy, to make it a tool of soft power, to make it an NGO explicitly. Brzezinski writes about this as well, that I think it's in Technocratic, Between Two Ages, he talks about Rome and the importance of Vatican II's liberalization, that it would turn it into this kind of a thing they hoped. And so since that time, there have been a few figures that I don't think were that adept at geopolitics and how the world really runs that kind of might have challenged this in varying ways. And that does not mean that I think they were heroes. They can be corrupt people in the system who make people running the system mad. So it doesn't make them heroes. So, for example, John Paul I, notoriously wanted to reform the Vatican Bank. And the Vatican banker of that time ended up hung underneath a bridge in England, and John Paul I ended up poisoned, that he was assassinated. So people like that, who might themselves just kind of be not, kind of ignorant of how world politics really works, they end up, finding out how it really works, right? In those positions of power, when you want to do something like, because the Vatican Bank is a giant organized crime money laundering bank connected to all the rest of the international banking structure as well. So that's what's really going on. And that's what happened at the time of Vatican II. And so since then, what you've had is various popes who have, in varying degrees, wanted to kind of either further the revolution that happened in the 1960s in the Catholic Church, or kind of maybe slow it down a little bit. So I think Benedict was one of these figures who, he's not actually a traditional person. He was exceptionally liberal at the time of Vatican II. He had all kinds of very radical ideas when he attended the council. But maybe by the time he was elected Pope, he sort of wanted to get, either he himself became a little more conservative, or wanted to give the appearance of being more conservative. But there was a lot of, that was during the time when a lot of the stuff was breaking about the pedo stuff. And a lot of that is blackmail. And so that is also part of these networks who blackmail it's not just high-level politicians. They blackmail high-level prelates as well. And I'm not excusing the prelates, because many of these prelates do have predilections for these kinds of activities, right? And so that's how the institutions beyond government, it's the exact same model as how they would corrupt, you know, politicians. So they corrupt and they blackmail high-level prelates, and that forces the revolution to go on. So my thought is that, and this other journalists have, I'm not a journalist, but other journalists have come to analyze the situation of Benedict pretty in depth, and that seems to be the case there as well, is that he was forced to step down because they wanted to go to the next phase of the revolution of the Roman Catholic Church. He may not have wanted that for whatever reasons, and so his stepping down had to do precisely with Francis being sort of, I guess, the chosen figure to take on the revolution to the next phase, because Francis is a long time sort of connected to the deep state kind of figure. Yeah. And this goes back into his history in where he was a cardinal, Cardinal Bergoglio, and he was tied into a lot of the right wing CIA operations there. Which may sound odd, like, well, isn't he a liberal? Yeah, but the CIA is not a conservative right-wing institution like people like, oh, they're fighting the commies. No, actually, they're furthering the agenda. It's the same people behind the CIA, or the people behind Bilderberg and Davos. So no, it has nothing to do with right and left wing. And so even though people might think of Bergoglio as a liberal, I mean, he's just part of this superstructure. And that's why he's pushing the World Economic Forum. He's pushing inclusive capitalism. He's pushing, which is just communism, socialism. He's pushing, you know, the green agenda. He's pushing UNESCO. He's pushing because he, and that's because of this Jesuit CIA connection that is well documented in not theories, but in scholars. So that's what's going on.
That's a good breakdown. And I saw that George Pell just died, which is fine with me.
Yeah, I think quite a few of these figures have kind of met untimely demises. But I also think a lot of these, not to being crass or rude here, a lot of these boomer prelates also took the stabbies because they, you know,
yeah,
they believed the system.
Well, speaking of that, since you sort of walked us right into the World Economic Forum, let's talk about this, because this is, we got into this on Sean's show talking about this rebranding of the term eugenics as transhumanism. And it's
Klaus's mentor is one of these liberal prelates. That's BF. I think he's like BFF with Bergoglio. You know what I'm talking about?
No, but
yeah. So Klaus has a Roman Catholic mentor. I'm trying to remember who this was. Oh, I never can remember. Let's see. Yeah, I think he's either a cardinal or an archbishop, and he is BFF with Francis.
Interesting.
And he's Klaus's quote mentor. Klaus, Roman Catholic prelate mentor.
And he's not being mentored by Kissinger or
Brazilian Archbishop Haider Camara. That's him. So if you look into him, he's the now again, people get confused because they think, oh, but if he's a socialist archbishop, he can't be part of the CIA because they're against socialism. No, they're not. Right. So this is a great article, by the way, just for reference, if you want to get into that,
I'll check that
down out. The road. That's LifeSite News, which is a Catholic site. LifeSite News did a good breakdown of this, how this figure relates to Francis and Klaus, by the way.
So these guys, if they've got to know what the plan is, be this Francis.
Oh, or, Francis's level, absolutely.
Yeah. And the plan is depopulation. Doesn't the Catholic Church want more Catholics on this planet? Don't they want more people?
This has really forced a lot of the Catholics to kind of come to grips with this. I mean, there's essentially a burgeoning schism within the Roman Catholic Church. It's kind of been burgeoning for a long time, but it's really kind of, Francis is really heightening up that, fork in the road, precisely because of what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got the World Economic Forum, who's should be meeting any day now. And
by the way, can I mention one last point?
Please do.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to keep cutting. I just keep remembering facts. One thing that's helpful to explain this, because a lot of people say, well, like Francis and Archbishop Camara are liberation theologians, right? So all that Latin American liberation theology, oh, that's a bunch of socialism. Yeah, it is socialism, but people think that they're against, Rockefeller money power. No, actually, Rockefellers were very instrumental in promoting and they wanted liberation theology. So a lot of people don't know that, but they were into liberation theology.
Well, the Rockefellers were busy. They had a lot going on. There's always projects. There's never an organization they didn't want to get their money involved in and start to corrupt. And then we wind up in Davos, where there's a lot of money starting to pool in there to push an agenda that is, I would just say, is incompatible with humanity. Transhumanism, the blending of man with machine into the fourth industrial revolution. This is clearly dangerous. But if you were rating their, if you were giving them a progress report on this 2030 agenda, this build back better, you'll own nothing and like it, how do you think it's going so far? Because it seems like they've been making some mistakes. It seems like they've been maybe trying to catch up, make up for lost time or something along those lines. But it seems to me like that it hasn't been as on schedule as they would have liked it. What's your take on this so far? And I know that we've got, seven more years to go until we hit that magical 2030 number, but as a report card early on, their like first trimester scores, what would you give them?
B minus.
Okay.
I mean, I think a lot of what they wanted to do, they got through. A lot of those documents and white papers said that when the global pandemic happened, they would be able to push a lot of justification for, essential, non-essential workers. That was a huge part of the plan that was written about in the early 80s. Wallace Harmon has a whole essay predicting the future where they would segregate everybody into essential and non-essential workers. He wrote that in 1982, which is pretty crazy.
Wow.
And then we have the automation, which the lockstep document said that after this pandemic, that would lead to the justification for the automation of everything. Then at the same time, we've seen the lockdowns being the justification for, Mother Earth can breathe now. She couldn't breathe before because everybody was going about their business and buying things and driving cars. And so now that we have lockdowns, we can see that it's healing the environment. So now we need more climate lockdowns. Nothing to do with COVID or with pandemic, but they couldn't have said any of that or tried to push any of that propaganda without the last, 2-3 years. So the last 2-3 years really were a big key in the next business phase, the plan that they wanted to roll out. But you're correct that, it seems that the power of lockdowns and pandemics seems to be waning. And a lot of people are waking up to, the vaccines are killing people and all that. Yeah. But did you know that in the SPARS document, it actually predicted that everybody would wake up to the vaccines killing people? And then the document, it says that when they wake up to it, they'll just blame it on the public officials, like who are basically the disposable patsies, like a Fauci or somebody like that. But Klaus and company, Gil Bates, they're never going to get in trouble, right? And that's kind of what the document is implying, that it will never be pinned upon the real culprits here. We'll just have some, front figures that take the brunt of the heat. So I think that in order to speed up the pro, well, I don't know if you saw catastrophic contagion, right? Bill Gates ran a new exercise. Yeah. So maybe that will be the card they play to speed up the process to get us to the numbers that they wanted by 2030. They want, you know, they wanted the depopulation to be pretty significant by 2030. That seems to not be going as fast as they want. I guess it'll kind of depend on how many people in the next 5 years, 7 years die from the stabbies, which, you know, people are dropping every day. So, but I don't think it's going to be billions.
No.
So either catastrophic contagion has to come or some kind of event, another catalyzing event that gives the justification for shutting down commerce, travel, car. But I mean, they're saying this, right? They're already saying it's time to ban cars. It's time to ban small engines. It's time to ban person-to-person commerce. It's time to ban cash. It's time to ban anything that's not CBDC. That's the next thing that's rolling out, central bank digital currency. So yeah, I would say they get a B minus, but that doesn't mean that they can't extend 2030's goals for 2040.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to Corbett about this right after the first lockdown started in March of the tail end of March of 2020. And he said, wouldn't it be crazy if we have this lockdown and we were sort of like in it? I wasn't really participating in it, but it was happening. And he said, what if they tell us to lock down and it's Netflix and chill for 2 weeks and everyone has a good time and they get their Peloton subscription and they start doing, you know, and then it's lifted and they say, all right, you guys can go back to, you know, real life. And everyone just says, oh, well, that wasn't that bad. And then the next time they come around, they say, oh, it's lockdowns again. Everyone goes, oh yeah, Netflix, Peloton, hanging out with my significant other, just chilling on the couch. And they, you know, easily voluntarily go back in the house. And he says, and this time they never let you out. I was he's like, I don't want to give these guys ideas, but it did occur to me that one of the things that they have accomplished to a certain degree.
I think that's what they tried in Australia.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They tried that.
I think they were testing how long can we force people to be locked out. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We will do Abercrombie and Fitch style ads where we show like these hot young girls that are sort of out in their quarantine camp, sitting on the patio, living their best lives and everything. But they did accomplish behavior modification, it seems like to me. It seems like they have conditioned people to now completely, I mean, listen, they got people to stand on a dot that was 6 feet away from another dot. And they got people to go one direction down the aisles in a grocery store.
Wear ridiculous masks for 2 years. Yep.
And do all this stuff. It felt like, if I didn't know any better, this was the psychological breaking of society that had to happen first. And then we were going to, and then in these continued phases as we march to 2030, we then get additional phases.
It's like dog training, right? Break the dog. And yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. They're like calm confidence, sit, you know. Well,
muzzles are, that's for animals, right?
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Right. We've been, you know, they told us we can go outside and go to the bathroom, which is
nice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You tell the dog, you train the dog when and how they can eat, what they can do, where they can and can't go. Can they go outside or not? Exactly. Interesting. Man.
Yeah. Well, look, I know we're coming to the end here. I got to let you go. I heard a rumor that Alex Jones has come to an agreement with the Sandy Hook parents. He has agreed to pay them $1 a year for the next 1.4 billion years. Can you confirm this?
That I don't know, but it sounds funny. It sounds like Alex. That's funny.
I'm just fucking around. I don't know. I mean, the whole thing.
That's a good one.
Yeah. The whole thing sounds crazy. Listen, we appreciate
$1 a year for a billion years.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds reasonable. They'll get there with inflation. What are you working on now? What's next on the agenda for you?
I think we'll try to do a live event in Austin. We've had a lot of fun doing our live events. We've done Nashville, Orlando. Next up, we'll do Austin. I think in February. I'm going to be on Timcast, I think, in about a week, maybe 8-9 days. I'll be on Timcast. Going to be on Dr. Steve Turley's channel, which is a large geopolitical focused channel. That'll be in the next coming weeks. So, yeah, we got a really busy next couple months. So, just stay tuned. Also, the course with Richard will be out, I think, either tomorrow or the day after that, so that will be on sale finally.
Well, by the time this gets out to the audience, it will be available. So where's the best place for people to find that? At Autonomy, A-U-T?
Yeah. They'll have a specific link for my page when that's up, but it'll be over at Autonomy Reason University. And you can find me over on Rockfin. You can find me on YouTube under my name. And then the fourth hour of Alex Jones every Friday.
Awesome. It's the best. That's Jay Dyer, everybody. Catch his stuff. Support his work. Sign up for his class. Hey, I'll tell you what. Talk to people that you know. And maybe if there's a special person in your life that you think might have an interest in this, talk to them and see if you might want to pick this this college-level class up course up for them to take. It sounds really fascinating. And I really like the direction everything is going. So support Jay's work. Jay, you're the best. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Charlie. Also, I want to get you to come on maybe in the next couple weeks, we can find a spot there. Definitely for sure in the near future, get you on my podcast as well. And Jeff as well, if he wants to come on.
Absolutely. I'll be down in Anarchapulco. I'll be hobnobbing with Ron Paul, pretending like I know him, which I don't, nice. But I will. So, hey, if you like this episode, you can take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can find me on Twitter at Macroaggression or the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
Lowe's knows how to help you save. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select Maytag laundry appliances. Plus, get an additional 10% off when you buy two or three select major appliances. And when you buy four or more, you'll save an additional 20%. Find the right appliances and features that fit your home's unique needs and style. Shop Maytag 4th of July deals at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.